This is the final talk on the series of six classes on the Four Noble Truths. And we're going to talk about the last part of the Fourth Noble Truth. So remember, the first part of the Fourth Noble Truth, well, it's hard to say, was basically that we had to have wise view. We had to understand why we were doing this, and then we had to set a wholesome intention. We had to head off in the right direction. And then the second part was all about how we acted in the world and lived in the world. Wise speech, right action, and wholesome livelihood. And now finally we get to the last three pieces here, and we're going to talk quite directly about actual formal practice. We have, wise effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And the thing about this is that even though I'm talking about, I'm going to emphasize more the actual formal practice, mindfulness practice form within this talk, we have to remember that this also has to do very directly with how we live our lives. I mean, we need to be mindful as we live our lives. We need to put in effort. We need to pay attention and concentrate. I mean, anybody who drives a car knows we got to concentrate when we're driving a car, for instance. So this is also very applicable to our life in the world. And so, as I said, the first of these is wise effort. And basically, we have to figure out how much energy do we want to put into this practice. Is there such a thing as too much, for instance? Is there such thing as not enough? Where's the, and here we are talking about the middle path, just like that, the middle ground between not enough and too much, right? But Ajahn Chah, from his book Being Dharma, has this great thing he says. He's talking about this whole concept. Practice really has to depend on steadfastness and patient endurance. There's two words, patience and endurance, two favorite words for people in the Western world, right? Some people start to practice meditation and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away, but the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there. So the practitioners will have to experience their ripening. It's important to make effort where this distress appears. We might feel we would be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We could eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We could go here and there as we wish and follow our impulses like this would bring well-being. The teachings of the Buddha talk about resisting, grating against things. The way of transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. And there's a scripture, there's a fable that illustrates this. Before the Buddha attained enlightenment, when he had accepted the eaten rice porridge on the milkmaid Sujata. So this is, the Buddha had just spent something like 5 years living this extremely austere life. They talk about him living on nettle soup and one grain of rice a day, and he was really thin and emaciated, and the idea being, well, we'll just suffer, and if we suffer enough, we'll understand suffering, and then we can overcome suffering. That was the idea. Didn't sound very pleasant, right? So then he left this. He's with a group of five others, and he left this group. They call them, Gautama the backslider, right? And he went and he came across this milkmaid who gave him this bowl of rice porridge. So the story goes. So he'd eaten the rice porridge, and then he set the dish on the surface of a southerly flowing river and made the aspiration: "If I'm going to become a supremely awakened Buddha, may the dish flow north." So the river is flowing south. The dish is going to have to flow against the current. The dish flowed to the north. What this story and what Ajahn Chah is pointing to is right effort, and putting effort into something like this often goes against the current of our culture. It often goes against the easy way. Let's just flow along. It'll be fine. Okay. And so, how do we look at this a little more closely? First off, you have to understand that we're all told, and I've said this many times, that we all have Buddha nature, right? Well, if I have Buddha nature, why do I have to practice at all? Seems like almost like a logical question, right? If I have Buddha nature, I'll just be a Buddha. I mean, that's no problem there. And in terms of absolute reality, this is true. You have Buddha nature, you are Buddha-like. But the truth is, most of the time, we don't live in the world of absolute reality. We live in the world of relative reality, where we don't always have the most pure and wholesome experiences, where we, to use the Buddhist word, suffer. And we get caught up in things. And we think, well, how come? And this is, back to the First Noble Truth in a way. It's like, if I have Buddha nature, why is there so much suffering in the world if we all have Buddha nature? And so some teachings then say, well, all I need to do is let go. Just let go, and everything will be fine. Sink into your true nature, right? It sounds so easy. Again, I'll just let go. But it isn't. Letting go is paradoxically takes great effort. Just letting go implies that we drop all our usual reactive habits of mind. Letting go means we have to let go of all the things we do that lead us into not being calm and clear and solid and steady. And because most of the time, we're functioning pretty much on autopilot. And we don't like to think this, but it's true. Most of the time, when we're going through our daily lives, we sort of get into a rhythm of habits of how things are and how we do things. And these might be quite wholesome habits, but we're not particularly mindful all the time. And we don't spend that much time in the present moment. Actually, we spend a lot of time either worrying about the future or, noodling about the past. How I shouldn't have done that, and how come that happened? And, that's where the predominant mental process is, not in the present moment at all. And so it's like we're just caught in these mind movies most of the time. Mind movies, which of course, we're almost the star of the movie, right? That's part of the deal. And so we have to somehow shift these embedded patterns of thinking and acting in the world. And that's where, we talk about effort. In Pali, the word for effort is virya. And the root of virya is the word vira. Vira means, traditionally means a warrior, right? Is one translation of it. But it basically means a warrior or a hero take up this path, to really put effort into it, is courageous, like a hero. It takes courage to go against the stream of our culture. It's not easy. And you're also taking making effort to see what your habitual patterns are and how they often lead you to places where you probably don't want to be. Right? How many times do we sort of be in the middle of something and go, how the heck did I end up here? How did I think this was not okay idea? Yeah. How could I have said that? How that's what we do. We're in the midst of it, and then we sometimes wake up if we're lucky, right? So we have to put in effort, but we can't put in too much effort. That's the tricky part. We think, well, I'm just going to grit my teeth and I'm going to do this. I'm going to become enlightened in 6 weeks. Yep, that's for sure. Which people do. Joseph Goldstein tells a story about like when he was first practicing, he was off on a retreat and he said, "I'm going to become enlightened this retreat." And then he was really disappointed when he wasn't. It was like he was, and he practiced. He's a serious practitioner, right? And he was like, "It isn't that easy. We can't just make up our minds and okay, now I'm going to do it." And if you, because what happens is, you get caught in this idea that somehow doing this practice is about succeeding. It's our Western culture, right? I have to be a success at this practice. I'm not just going to be good, I'm going to be real, I'm going to be the best practitioner, right? Or we have to do it to fill some sort of obligation to ourselves or to the community or whatever. And so you should be practicing all the time. And there's this old adage, actually, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, right? This is a classic adage, and it's true. We can't, if we take ourselves too seriously, if we what happens is we turn this practice into this sort of grim duty. And before you know it, it's like, oh God, I have to sit again this morning. And you quit because it's turned in, there's no joy there. And so we're trying to find this balance all the time with putting in effort that leads onward but doesn't drive us into the ground, right? Some this balance between these two extremes. We can't just sort of lay back. Oh, I'm enlightened. I'm naturally enlightened because I have Buddha nature, and kick back and do nothing. That's one extreme, and the other is like I'm going to practice 16 hours a day. That's it. I'm just going to sit here and grin and grow with grim and sometimes. Practicing 16 hours a day for a while on a long retreat is actually a useful thing to do. But as a way to lead your life, for most of us, it'll just make us crazy. It'll make us really unhappy. So there's that balance we have to find. So what does right effort mean? What does wholesome effort, what does wise effort mean? And traditionally, the way it's taught is there are four aspects to right effort, to wise effort. And they all have to do with how what's happening affects you at the level of mind. So the first aspect is to do whatever you can to prevent unwholesome states of mind from arising. So in practice, there you are sitting there just meditating quietly. And this old familiar pattern comes up, and you go silently, you're going, oh, I know where this goes. I know where I'm gonna, this is gonna lead me into that whole fantasy about this and that and blah, 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 or that old story about how horrible those people were, and they get all grumpy and angry, whatever, you know the story. And you just have to be able, you learn over time, partly because you're learning how to be mindful enough to see these things arising before you get really caught in them. And you go, yeah, I don't need to go there. And you just, this is part of letting go. You know, we talked about letting go. This is actually a part of letting go. I'm going to let go of that story. It doesn't serve me in any way. All it does is lead me to unwholesome places. So I'm just not going to give that story any attention at all. And this is like, in a sense, this is putting, wise understanding into action. I know where this goes, so there's no sense in me going there, right? It's just, and sometimes the way to do that is you see this old pattern and you know where it goes, and if you can laugh at it, just go, oh, just that one again, and have a little giggle. Like, just because you don't take it seriously. It's because you know it's just some old pattern. It arose, it's going to be there for a while, it's going to be gone anyway. Everything is that has that nature. You know it's not going to be there. And so you laugh at how ridiculous it is that it's there again. Oh my God, I can't believe that. So that's practice sitting on the cushion. What about in daily life, however? And in daily life, I think this first aspect of wise effort has this another flavor in a sense, where you need to actually look at our lives really closely, look at all the things we do, habitually things we do, the places we go, the people we hang out with, and see that some of those things lead to places that aren't wholesome, lead us to these places that cause us suffering for ourselves and for others. But this requires that we actually look. Here we are in the three, third, fourth, and fifth steps, right? But this is what part of what those steps mean is like actually put the effort in to look, examine, contemplate the things in your life that lead you to places that where you have unwholesome speech and action, and go, oh, I don't need to do that anymore. I know. This was something I experienced in my 20s. And like, if I go out with these guys to the bar again, I know where this is going to go. So I just stopped doing it. Was hard. It wasn't easy. Because this is the guys I'd hung out with all through university, right? They were the boys. But it just didn't work for me anymore. And I realized that and started to shift at that point. But it's like we have to be aware, we have to be mindful, see the look. So the second aspect of right effort is to do whatever you can to get rid of unwholesome mind states once they have arisen. So you didn't see it at the beginning, and there you are sitting there, and you notice that you're just wound again. Here I am, wound up again. Oh, I'm caught in this unwholesome mind state. And now you have to sort of put effort here because I see that I'm caught. I'm experiencing the unwholesomeness. I can feel the emotional pull of these things, the emotional energy that feels yucky, to put a very Buddhist word, yucky. And I can feel it in my body, the tension, the heat, the jitteriness, whatever. And so now I go, oh, I have to not do this. Have to stop this. So here we're actually saying, at this point, we have to sort of consciously steer what's arising a little bit, so we sort of steer out of the stream of this blah 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 horrible the story that's got us caught. So we're actually going to make a choice here. When we're initially teaching mindfulness, we're always to say, we'll just pay attention to what's arising. And that's absolutely true. But at a certain point, If it's the same old story and you've actually consciously looked at it carefully, sat with it, paid attention to it, and here you are again, reliving that old story again with some slight variation because you think if I just vary it a bit, it'll be better. We fool ourselves that way a lot too. Then you go, no. There's this whole teaching in the sutta about the five different ways you can shift from unwholesome mind state. The classic one is, if you see that you're in an unwholesome mind state, consciously choose to shift the pattern to something wholesome. Not always easy to do, but it's like, so for instance, and this is my favorite one, I'm caught in one of these stories where there's someone that's the villain of the story, right? And I'm ranting about them and how bad they are and how poorly they treated me, blah, 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 blah. And if at that point, if I see it and I can consciously choose, instead of all this ill will towards this person, let's have thoughts of loving kindness towards him. And if I can, I actually can some, well, actually directly shift to metta practice, right in the middle of my quote mindfulness practice, and have thought and have consciously choose to have thoughts of loving kindness for this person. It's a classic way to shift. Another one that also I found to be quite successful is, I'm caught in this story and I'm way up here in my mind and I'm all caught, and it's this consciously slow down the practice so that I drop out of the mind as much as I can, drop into the body, and just tune into the breath to the exclusion of everything else. Like, the very first teaching of the Buddha on mindfulness, right? Mindfulness of breath. Okay, that's all I'm going to do. I'm going to consciously push away from those other things and just tune into the breath and make that the conscious choice. I'm shifting. And this is where the skill in the practice arises more than any place else, I think. Because the temptation is, of course, something unpleasant has arisen. And you haven't really looked at it or paid attention to it, but it's there and it's really unpleasant. Oh, I'm going to shift. That doesn't work either. Because we have to be honest about, oh, this is unpleasant. Let's pay attention to the unpleasantness and really tune into it, and do that more than once for these your favorite stories. But at some point, it's like, oh, it's just that one again. Now I know I should shift. And how do you make that choice, and where you make that choice? This is where the skill of practice is really arising more than many other places, I think. This understanding that sometimes it's okay to not just be there in the moment with what's arising, but actually choose to shift the story, to change the channel. Right. A little bit of Joseph Goldstein here. I love this. This is a little bit humorous, but this is Joseph talking about this. When all else fails, the Buddha suggested forcibly suppressing the unwholesome thoughts. One way of doing this is imagining oneself shooting down these thoughts as soon as they arise, like shooting down targets at an amusement park shooting gallery game. I found this method particularly helpful with recurrent unwholesome thoughts that have already been seen so many times that it's not a question of denial or suppression of feeling. Here, it's an attitude that takes no quarter, but involves a sense of humor. I call this method cowboy dharma. He's actually imagining shooting down these unwholesome thoughts. I'm not suggesting we all need to practice cowboy dharma, but it is like we can once again notice a sense of humor here. Even in this dire situation of being caught in a really unwholesome mind state, if you can have a sense of humor about it, like, oh God, that one again. Then sometimes just that little sense of humor and this little shift in ideas and the vision idea of shooting them down in his case. Maybe you want to spear them or flush them down the toilet. I don't care what image you use, but we have to get rid of them somehow, right? I'm going to forcefully get rid of them. Sometimes that's what we have to do to deal with this particular idea. So those are the first two. Do what you can to avoid having unwholesome mind states arise, and then just do whatever you can to get rid of unwholesome mind states once they've arisen. So the second two parts of right effort are essentially the flip side of the coin of these two. So the third aspect is do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Seems like a no-brainer, huh? Do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Remember the word, and the word cultivate is something you see in the translations a lot. Cultivate means actually put some effort into having wholesome mind states arise. Do things that bring calm, joy, compassion, loving kindness, and equanimity into your life on a regular basis. How often do we do this? How often do we consciously go, oh, I think I'm going to just have a day where I'm going to sort of slow down and focus on what's calm for me right now? Or what brings me joy? Wholesome joy, of course. And consciously choose to do that. And this is all about. This is that idea of wholesome intention. I'm going to form a wholesome intention to have more joy, to have more compassion, to be calmer. Whatever your favorite one it might be, or one you feel like you need in the moment. But this is a conscious choice we make. This is effortful again. Because if we just sort of go along with our daily life and don't think about this stuff, we often are just caught in all those stories. That's where we live. The fourth and final aspect of whatever is often the most difficult. This is actually kind of tricky. When wholesome mind states have arisen in the mind, do whatever you can to preserve them. Here you are. Calmly sitting there, being mindful, and you notice, oh, calm has arisen. I feel really joyful right now. I feel serene, whatever, words you might use. So first of all, we have to be mindful enough to notice them, which is in itself difficult because we're sort of hardwired physiologically to look for all the bad stuff. To look for all the things that are wrong. Because this is how we survived out there on the plains when we were, had to worry about being eaten by saber-toothed tigers and living in little tribes, right? It's just deep in our brainstem, that's how things are. And so, the first thing is be mindful that they're there. And the second thing, and this is tricky actually, is to have to accept it. Oh, joy has arisen, and that's okay. Feel like it's okay to be joyful and calm. Because often what happens is, instead we go, oh, I can't be calm like this. I need to be stay on the edge, be careful. Who knows what's going to happen? There you are in a wholesome mind state, just like that. You didn't preserve the wholesome. You shifted directly into an unwholesome mind state instead. Worry. Or, even worse, I suppose, I don't deserve to be this happy. That's an unwholesome mind state. That's like putting yourself down. I don't deserve to be happy. And I'm telling you, I'll tell you this right out, everyone deserves to be happy. Everyone deserves to experience joy without exception. Everyone, including us. sitting here right now together. And that, but that's what we do. We cut off the wholesome mind states, which is the reason by trying to figure them out or make them into something more, instead of just going, oh, this is kind of nice. Maybe I'll just, I know it's, I've been sitting for half an hour already, but I feel really calm and still. Maybe I'll just sit here a bit longer. And even though normally I'd get up after half an hour, right? Because I guess my schedule. No, right now I feel calm and still. I think I'll just stay here for a while. Just recognizing that that wholesome mind state has arisen, and then choosing to just cultivate it a little longer. Because you know it's going to go away. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like wholesome mind states, just like every other mind state, they arise and they're for a while and then they're gone. So you really enjoy it while it's there. That's really wholesome effort. And so all of these effortful things imply underneath what I've been saying in the sense is these are all choices we make. Over and over, over again, we're confronted with choices we can make to not get caught in an unwholesome mind state, to do what we can to get rid of it, to consciously do things that we know lead us towards wholesome mind states, or to actually enjoy wholesome mind states when they arise. These are all choices we make, whether it's in our life or in our practice. And so it's a matter of learning to make wise effort, in a sense, is just learning to make wise choices more often. Over and over and over, all day long, for the rest of our lives. But that's what it implies, that we're making these choices. After wise effort, we come to, you know, right concentration and white mindfulness. And in a sense, the other six steps have all led us to these two, to right mindfulness and right concentration. They were like laying the groundwork, right? But what we have to remember is that both mindfulness and concentration are wholesome mind states. There's that word again, wholesome mind states, that arise due to causes and conditions, as they say. They arise when we have consciously created the causes and conditions such that they might arise in the first place. And this is, it's a really, I think it's quite a good definition of this whole practice. You know, are we doing what we can? Are we creating the causes and conditions in our life such that the wholesome states of mindfulness and concentration will arise? Understanding that they are mind states just like everything else. They'll arise, they'll be there for a while, and they'll be gone. So can we create the wholesome causes and conditions that they arise, and maybe hopefully over time arise more frequently and last longer? That's what we're trying to do with the practice, in a sense. So mindfulness, the actual formal practice of mindfulness, has all kinds of different techniques and methods, and you see it taught in all kinds of different ways. And that's because the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, is quite lengthy. And has, especially in the first section of mindfulness of body, has all kinds of different suggestions on ways. I mean, you know, if you really like the idea of sitting in a charnel ground watching bodies decay, this is an actual practice, right? It doesn't really appeal to me, but that was one of the things that the Buddha taught. Yeah, but you know, people choose and adapt various forms of the physical teachings of the Buddha in the first part of that Satipatthana Sutta, the first foundation of mindfulness. And we find sort of what works for us in a sense. And I want to read something else. This is from Joseph again. And he's talking very directly here about right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is the essential key to practice. It is the first of the factors of enlightenment, which I'm going to talk about next week, right? And gives rise to all the others. Mindfulness is the presence of mind, the quality of awareness, often described as bare attention. Bhikkhu Bodhi described it very well. In the practice of right mindfulness, the mind is trained to remain in the present, open, quiet, and alert, contemplating the present event. All judgments and interpretations have to be suspended, or if they occur, just registered and dropped. The task is simply to note whatever comes up just as it's occurring, riding the changes of events in the way a surfer rides the waves of the sea. The whole process is a way of coming back into the present, of standing in the here and now without slipping away, without getting swept away by the tides of distracting thoughts. To practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. Just that idea of letting go again. You know, undoing our habitual patterns of getting lost in anything other than the present moment. Although the practice of mindfulness is very simple, it is not always easy to do. As we know, our minds often get lost in mental proliferation of overlaying concepts, evaluations, and likes and dislikes regarding the bare experience of what is happening. And there can be also a non-conceptual identification with the experience itself, the creation of a sense of self that hinders mindful, bare attention. There's always, what he's pointing to is that idea of, oh, I am feeling a pain in my knee, as opposed to pain has arisen. Two different ways of seeing things. One is personalized and the other is, well, this is what's there right now. Doesn't have to be an I or am I there. And to help clarify the difference between ordinary, conventional knowing and mindful knowing, I use the example of black lab consciousness. Those of you who have dogs will appreciate this. Have you ever watched the playful antics of Labrador retrievers? The black labs clearly recognize sights and sounds and particular smells. But when they play, the lab just runs from one sense impression to the next, literally being led around by the nose. There is no apparent mindfulness of what they are doing. It describes dogs, it also describes us a lot of the time. We're being just led around by all of our senses, looking for another hit of sweet stuff, something that smells good, tastes good, whatever, feels good. It's pretty, I like the image. So that's mindfulness. Then concentration. And concentration basically arises when mindfulness is continuous. When mindfulness becomes more continuous, when we have our practice going well and mindfulness has arisen, and last, then concentration deepens. That the mental formation of mindfulness, of concentration arises as a result of being mindful. And The thing about concentration is we have to understand there's really, in a sense, two forms. And we see both of these when we practice. One is this idea of concentration on anything that's arising in the moment, what's most obvious in the moment. So this is what's called moment-to-moment concentration, where there's no fixed object. Sometimes called open awareness or bare attention, as Joseph pointed it to. The other is to actually have a particular object of meditation, and you fix on that. This is where all mantra practices and visualization practices that you see in other traditions are headed. In the Christian tradition, they have these wholesome prayer things they have. These are all concentration in the sense of I choose a specific mental object and fix my mind on that. In our tradition, metta is this form of concentration practice. It's like we choose these simple phrases and tune into the meaning. So it's a pretty broad compared to, say, a mantra, which might just be like a sound, but it's still a very fixed idea. And both of these are forms of concentration, open concentration and more fixed, one-pointed concentration. And sometimes, and here's another aspect of this, is sometimes when you're practicing, you might see, let's say you're sort of practicing sort of, anchored awareness or open awareness, or just tuning into whatever's arising in the mind. And it's like chaos today. You're sitting there thinking, and this is like your mind is just like, bleh, one story after another, jumping around, restless, worry, all kinds of things going on. At that point, sometimes it can be quite skillful to go, no, I think I'm going to shift from this open space to a very precise, simple practice, like the breath, or like metta even. Just like, let's just simplify. Let's just drop down to something really simple and hang out there. Even though I decided when I sat down here this morning or this afternoon, whenever you're practicing, that I was going to practice this sort of more open awareness method, right now my mind isn't going there. And so I choose to do something really simple and focused to get the mind to still and build up some energy of concentration. And then you might open up to the wider perspective again. Vice versa. You sit, oh, I know, you sit down and you can just feel as you sit, oh my God, my mind's a train wreck before I even started. And you might do some form of this precise concentration practice for the first 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then you notice, because you're being mindful, of course, oh, things are sort of calmed down now. Why don't I open up to something wider? And this is another area where skill in the practice comes, where we learn to shift back and forth between these two extremes, in a sense, two different forms of concentration. Because at some particular time, based on what's going on in the rest of in our minds and bodies, it's clear that we need to do one or the other. And this is skillful. This is where skill has to be applied to the practice. And we learn over time to make wise decisions along these lines instead of like gritting our teeth. Oh, I'm doing open awareness. No, sorry. So it's a train wreck. I mean, and though sometimes, Joseph points out, sometimes he said the only thing he could note when the mind was really wound up was he would just note chaos. What's going on right now? Chaos. That might work too. But even that's like, that's a one word thing. So it's like, I've got this sort of way of describing the entire thing in one word. Ah, so it's more concentrated than just sort of being open to everything. Just open to the fact that chaos has arisen. It's all in figuring things out and being skillful in choosing one or the other. So, what I've been trying to point at here is that we have to find some sort of skillful combination of effort and mindfulness and concentration, and somehow blend those together. And at different times, have lean more strongly towards one of these or the other. We need all three, and some skillful mixture and balance of these three that bring about a fruitful practice. And it's, once again, that's how we have to learn how to do that. Finally, I want to point out one thing. I've already said this before, I think, in this series of talks, but I think it's just, we call this the Eightfold Path, right? But the word path implies some sort of linear process. I start here and I go there. And it's not. I think I keep coming back to saying, well, while you're applying right effort, you have to be mindful. Well, now, wait, I thought I was talking about right effort, but I don't know. All these factors interrelate and interplay with each other, number one. And number two, as we sort of our practice matures and we go deeper into the practice, we come back to, say, right view, and we go, oh, I thought I had right view, but that was, and it was good. I had right view, but now I see much deeper into how things are. Now I have to sort of refine what I see is right view. I have to look a little deeper and see if I can put that all together now that I've learned things along the way. And then, oh, that maybe that deeper understanding means I have to reform my intention. And around we go again. Okay. So I love the image of the practice being a spiral. We keep going around in circles, and the circles get deeper and deeper. Being a good Canadian, I know all about open pit mining. If you've ever seen an open pit mine, it's just basically a big spiral, and there's this road around the edge of the pit that goes down deeper and deeper and deeper. People, often you see in spiritual practice people use that image of a mountain. We're all going up. I think we're all going down into the pit until we all get to the place in the at the core of the pit where the gold is. Right. Let's all practice open pit meditation. It's a, it's an, I like it because it has that spiral thing. I had a friend once who used to drive the trucks in open pit mines, and he was always talking about what it was like driving up and down those roads. So let's finish off with a little bit of poetry here. And I know you've all heard me read this before, but I keep coming back to this poem. This is Mary Oliver's Why I Wake Early, a poem called Mindful. Every day I hear or see something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. Ah, start with joy. It's what I was born for. To look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclimation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself. How can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. We have to remember over and over again that It's the little things, it's the simple things that are important. It's so easy to turn this practice into trying to make some big thing happen. And big things happen sometimes in this practice. I'm not going to deny that. But trying to make them happen is a form of unskillful effort. Instead, just pay attention to all the little things and let joy and acclamation be what this practice is all about.